From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Is there a threat that the U.S. may repeat airstrikes against Syria?
That was Russia's President Vladimir Putin speaking at a press conference in Moscow held jointly with the visiting Italian President Sergio Mattarella. Putin was asked by an Italian journalist whether he anticipated more chemical attacks or U.S. airstrikes in Syria.
You asked whether new airstrikes are possible. We have intelligence showing that such provocations, and I don't have any other words, such provocations may happen in other parts of Syria as well, including the territory south of Damascus. They plan to use some substances and then accuse the Syrian government of using those chemicals. We believe every incident should be properly investigated, so we plan to contact the UN institution at The Hague, and we urge the international community to investigate the incident. And then, based on this investigation, the outcome of this investigation, a proper decision has to be made.
For more on that, we bring you part two of our one-hour conversation this past weekend with Mark Sloboda, retired U.S. naval officer and senior lecturer at Moscow State University in international relations. Okay, Mark, so let's pick it up where we left off yesterday. We have the carrier group headed to North Korea, the U.S. naval carrier group. You have, the strike by the U.S., the rhetoric coming out of Washington, the disregard of the charge of illegality of this action at the U.N. Security Council on two occasions, a pretty scary scenario developing. On top of that, Russia demonstrated almost immediately that it was going, and the Syrian army or air force, that they were going to continue to prosecute this war against the terrorists there aggressively. They bombed the hell out of a couple of places, and a removal of the rules of disengagement or whatever that little regime was called. And so you have Americans shooting at one side and Russians shooting at another, and they're in the same airspace.
Yeah, let's go back first to the results of this strike. We've already mentioned that according to Russian sources, only a small number of, about a third of these missiles actually hit their targets. They obviously did not do a lot of damage. The airways were obviously unimpeded. Trump even made a tweet about that, trying to justify it, saying that airways are easy to repair.
Yeah, which of course is, not entirely true. If you did some bunker buster bombs, for example, and make big craters in that thing, then it's going to
Okay, well, these weren't bunker buster bombs. They were Tomahawks. They were cruise missiles.
Understood.
But still, 59 is a pretty heavy salvo.
Yeah.
Now, it is normal for when you fire large number for cruise missile salvos to have a failure rate. That is true for both Russia. The U.S. made a big deal out of it when they fired their calibers
Look at NASA. Yeah. Launches there. That's just how they work. That's the reliability factor.
Cruise missiles. It's absolutely normal. And the U.S., when they fire these large cruise missile salvos, they have a failure rate too. But this seems much higher than that, if we can believe the Russian story. Now, we do know, as far as I know, the Russians did not use their S-300 or S-400 air defense systems, which are also missile defense,
right,
which supposedly have a high probability of taking down. They can track up to 300 targets, fire very quickly, and supposedly they have a fairly good chance, at least on paper, of taking the Tomahawks down. That's what the military experts say.
They may not have wanted to show their hand to the U.S. military.
They may not have wanted to show their hand, especially they did receive prior warning. It wasn't a political warning. It was a last-minute military deconfliction notice,
right,
because there were Russians stationed at this base, Russian troops and Russian helicopters stationed at this base. So they had enough time to evacuate and notify the Syrians, but not much else. Maybe for this reason, maybe not to show their hand because they knew there would be minimal damage, they decided not to fire these. But there is another possibility with this high failure rate according to the Russians. The Russians might have used electronic warfare jamming. And the U.S. is extremely worried about this. There were some incidences in the Black Sea where supposedly a Russian jet was able to completely immobilize a U.S. Warship's radar and defense systems. And there have been a lot of chatter out of how advanced the Russian electronic warfare was that was deployed in support of the Donbas, eastern Syria, I mean in eastern Ukraine. So there is that possibility, but that is just speculation by me and a few others on that. But whatever, we know that there was an immediate reaction from Russia. Of course, they condemned all of this, exactly what it is, an illegal aggression, brazen defiance of the UN Security Council, another trumped up, and Putin used those words, trumped up pretext. Weapons of mass destruction pretext, and you know this was another assault on the not only Syria but on the UN Charter and the concept of sovereignty, and you know international peace itself.
Right.
They immediately said that they were going to strengthen the Syrian air defense systems. They said we can assume that they are going to increase the Russian footprint on the ground as of deterrent value. And they canceled military deconfliction with the United States. The U.S. is upset about this, and they have good reason to be because there is advanced Russian air defense systems, S-300, S-400, Growler by the NATO determination on the ground that can now that are now potentially a threat to any U.S. or its, coalition of the willing aircraft that largely have annexed the skies over East Syria.
Let's put that in context, okay? What you're talking about, an air defense system against, an aerial attack means shooting down the planes. And, they've been playing a lot, and it's starting to make sense to me now, on cable here in the U.S., this movie. It's a docudrama called 13 Days, which is a dramatic interpretation of the events that took place around the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 1962. And in particular, there's this scenario where they talk about the rules of engagement that as it applies to flyovers, and these were reconnaissance flyovers by U.S. Military aircraft of Cuba to inspect missile sites, would provoke necessarily air defense response, which could involve the shooting down of an American plane. The rules of engagement are that you then have to attack the site and perhaps like sites that are a threat to U.S. Air activity in the future. And so this apparently logically follows by their military doctrine, and we're being educated about that at the time that the Russians are installing air defenses and expanding air defenses, giving notice that the air defenses are active and withdrawing from the prior rules of deconfliction, essentially a polarization of the military activity in Syria between Russia and the U.S., and under rules of engagement that likely involve if a U.S. Plane is shot down by Russian-provided equipment or some assistance given, that that's an attack by Russia upon the United States, and retaliation against those Russians is required.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, for those who aren't aware, the S-300, the S-400 systems are regarded by many military experts, analysts, to be the best in the world. This and the electronic warfare are probably the two, and maybe some submarines, some diesel submarines, are maybe the only areas where the Russian military is more advanced than the United States in these select areas, simply because with the overwhelming power of the U.S. Air Force, Russia, and numbers, the Soviet Union and then Russia decided to concentrate more on air defense than on trying to match number for number MiGs against F-16s and stealth bombers and so on. And Putin very pointedly said that earlier, something along the lines of, don't think your stealth things will do you any good. We can shoot down your stealth things.
Right.
So this is a serious threat. Now, there's, of course, these are part of an integrated system. We can suppose it would work with the older Soviet-provided S-200s, Panzers, and other systems that Syria has as well. It would be a fairly good air defense network. Of course, under a combined theoretical assault of U.S. Air Force in the region, Turkish Air Force, Israeli Air Force, and possibly Saudi as well, it's simply wouldn't stand up under those numbers, but it would do a fairly significant amount of damage, I believe, before it went down.
Well, I mean, the choke point would be the shooting down of one plane, and so we're talking maybe the first wave or two would be severely impacted.
They would, of course, try cruise missiles before they, as they did with this initial salvo, but the problem is the S-300 and S-400 are mobile. That limits the ability in any conflict situation for the cruise missiles to be able to take them out on their own.
Not only that, though, see, if you have a cruise missile attack on an S-400 site and some Russians are killed, then the U.S. did a first strike against Russia, in essence.
Yes, absolutely. Now, as to this deconfliction, this is serious because this is Russia, in a way, putting their own troops on the line, because deconfliction is the channels through which the Trump administration, the military, at least the Pentagon, contacted Russia and warned them to get out of this base, just to say, in completely ignoring the deterrent value of the Russian presence, saying you have no choice but to leave or die, which Russia is not going to react well to, of course. But in a way, that this is Trump calling their bluff. They moved their forces so they weren't killed. But this deconfliction right now, the Trump has no way of communicating that via military channels anymore, no formal way with a rapid response already built into it. So this is Putin saying, you don't know where, and that goes along with the cooperation, the informing about each other's activities and areas, which has ended. This is Putin saying, you don't know where Russian troops are now. Anything you attack, you may hit Russian troops. And of course, there's also the possibility of incidents in the air, mistakes, these kinds of World War One type events that could lead. So it is a high risk. It is a gamble. It is an escalation by Russia. But I don't think you'll see any further military. There won't be any direct military response by Russia to this. A quid pro quo, a proportional response, would be increased air attacks against any U.S. Vetted rebels in the country. I mean, Al-Zinki or any of these other head choppers, a flat out, and then perhaps strikes on the training bases in Jordan and Turkey elsewhere where they're being trained. But I don't think we're going to see that, not immediately. Russia is extremely upset about the unpredictability of the Trump response, considering the 180-degree turn. They find it hard to believe that he was pulled in this rapidly by the propaganda, and they assume, as I do, that this is probably simply for petty domestic political concerns to get the deep state off his back, and that he could flip so quickly, whether for emotive reasons, as he says, the beautiful babies that they killed, vice the beautiful babies that I've been killing, or for this domestic political reasons. They find it very unpredictable, and it scares them. It's kind of a madman gambit.
The troubling thing to me about the withdrawal from the from the deconfliction regime is the fact that it provides an enabling narrative for a U.S. first strike by cruise missiles that does take out some Russians somewhere, and then basically Trump saying, "Well, we tried to call you on the phone, but you didn't pick up." and using that as an excuse that this was accidental, we had no intention to kill Russians, but you're in a dangerous spot and you should get out.
Yeah, well, remember during the campaign, Michael Morell, the former acting director of the CIA and a Clinton surrogate, telling Charlie Rose to his face that we need to start killing Russians and Iranians, particularly in Syria. So that would definitely go there. But that is the Russian response. That's where they are right now. Increased footprint, air defense, canceling deconfliction, but for the moment, no direct military response. Now the media comes into this. The media, the think tanks and the Democrats. And while they were initially celebrating and ecstatic over this, when it wasn't immediately followed up, it was this initial 59 cruise missile salvo, and that's it. And then the word that Russia at least was given at least some warning before it hit so they could pull their troops out, which of course also enabled Syria some amount of evacuation, limited damage done to the airbase. And suddenly the media and the Democrats, the neocons and others have turned on Trump once again.
It's not enough.
The new narrative that is actually being peddled in the past 24, 48 hours is that Russia is the one who launched the chemical attack. Not Syria. And, first of all, assuming that a chemical attack actually took place on this al-Qaeda stronghold. And again, no Western journalist has mentioned at all that this is an al-Qaeda stronghold in their reporting on this. They did previously before the attack, but suddenly since the attack, no one seems to remember that it is an al-Qaeda stronghold. Right. Although the Pentagon did mention that it was an attack on an al-Qaeda hospital. Al-Nusra Hospital. I guess Al-Qaeda's running hospitals.
It's charities.
They're charity.
On this point of what was actually there, you spoke, before about the fact that, these are binary agents, that you have, two components that are kept, separate from each other. So, and it only becomes active when they're mixed. My father took over as manufacturing superintendent at Mallory Battery in the mid-60s, and they made mercury batteries at this plant. And they used to clean the materials. They gave an acid bath to the cans that the batteries sit in. And it used sulfuric acid and sodium cyanide. Those were the two components. When he took over as manufacturing superintendent, he got a tour of the plant, and he found the storage facility where there were barrels lined up on one side of this long corridor and barrels lined up on the other side. And on the floor were these little pieces that looked almost like styrofoam, like the popcorn people that come in packaging, and these little puddles of sulfuric acid and this other agent. Now, I'm assuming he was petrified and he had them go from one end of the plant and the other end of the plant immediately. He made everyone get off the line and transport these things that day. You imagine an aerial strike on that plant. And the idea that the two components won't mix massively is an absurdity.
Yeah, well, the OPCW spokesman already said that it's certainly a possibility. And actually, in a roundabout way, McMaster's admitted that himself when he said that the U.S. Airstrikes on the Syrian airbase did everything they could to avoid hitting where they say sarin gas was kept. Also, it would, of course, be in this binary form. So if it wouldn't possibly mix, why would they worry about hitting it? So that kind of ruins the own challenge that has been presented to the Russian narrative, at least on technical grounds. But that's a constant thing during this entire conflict. There's constant small accusations of chemical weapon use, often with chlorine and so on. And chlorine, of course, is a very common ingredient in any type of water filtration, by almost everyone.
And bleach,
a whole scope of industrial chemicals that are used, stored, in any type of factory, warehouse, everything. After I got out of the military, I did 2 years in semiconductor engineering, and some of the gases they used in manufacturing facilities like that are very extremely hazardous, fragile, you know, very, very prone to accidents. Yeah. So you don't understand when you're launching airstrikes, you know, against it, you know, a foe that is, you know, entrenched itself in an urban area. There's all kinds of gases that can easily be released and mistaken for relatively mild effects of chemical weapons. Right. And I mean, just the idea that the Syrian government, it's winning on the ground. It's been winning for a long time now. It's taken back East Aleppo. It's taken back almost all of what they consider useful Syria. They have won a diplomatic victory by the U.S. saying they have the right to exist at least, you know, right, to elections, that, you know, that they're not trying for regime change anymore. But now suddenly he's going to use chemical weapons, which are an extremely inefficient military weapon. Right.
Which, you know, had no real useful military impact if that was a chemical strike.
I mean, the idea of what they would be, sarin would be used for, is a quick clearing out of the personnel of an area.
Right.
So that within less than 24 hours, you know, several hours later, most of the sarin has evaporated into the environment, then you can then move
occupy,
in.
Well,
of course, this wasn't part of any plan.
Right.
So the only justifications really left for why Assad would do this is simply sadistic terror against al-Qaeda, or he's insane. I mean, that's what you're left with.
Right, or he's trying
to commit
suicide.
You can say
right.
lots of things about Assad, but
he's not insane.
And his government, they're not insane.
Right.
They've had very rational, you know, very, you know, predicated, if cold-blooded response, you know, to this entire thing, as any government, I think, in that situation would.
Right.
So there's so many reasons, so many holes. I just find it frightening again how quickly the media rolls over and just goes with this narrative, you know, especially flying in the face that it's essentially being presented by al-Qaeda via social media to them.
Right.
And that's what they're reporting on.
Right.
But so back, the Democrats are now accusing that the chemical attacks were launched by Putin in order to help Trump, in order to get him out of their investigation and away from accusations wow. that he's Putin's puppet. And that then Trump warned Putin of the attacks on the facility, so there wasn't any real attacks, as it were. And this is all part of the Trump-Putin grand conspiracy. That's what is now being spun on MSNBC and elsewhere. And there's probably one last thing. This is, at time of recording, this is unconfirmed. But what is confirmed is that Nikki Haley has Trump's hapless, incompetent, completely unqualified appointee as a permanent representative of the U.S. to the United Nations. She has once again iterated, in her words, contradicting Tillerson, that this is not a one-off strike, that the U.S. now is settled once again on regime change against Assad. And unconfirmed, as of the time of recording, there are numerous reports of an incident on the Jordanian-Syrian border. Supposedly, there was a large explosion. There are reports that the U.S. And Jordan have both sent in a small contingent of troops, supposedly to save rebels who are fighting ISIS in the area.
This is right after that meeting between Trump and...
Yes. Now, that's unconfirmed as of yet, but it also follows assertions by Israel in the past, the past 48, 72 hours, that they felt that they would have to now move into Syria and create buffer zones along both the Israeli border and the Jordanian border in order to prevent Hezbollah from exploiting the situation. So essentially, they you know, beyond already the Golan Heights, they're already intending to do exactly what Turkey is doing in the north of Syria, a land grab. And that brings us up to, is partition, you know, if regime change is attempted again, or, you know, is partition, you know, already going on?
Yeah, I'm looking at Haaretz right now. Netanyahu seeks buffer zones against Iran and Hezbollah on Syria's borders with Israel and Jordan.
In Jordan. And then we have this incident, unconfirmed again, reports that I've gotten. This is from Al-Mazdar, which I consider to be a very reliable, it's a pro-Syrian government source, but they've been, I think, really accurate on the conflict so far.
Which counts. That counts a lot. And here you go. By the way, isn't the Golan Heights already a buffer zone?
Yeah, it's already an illegal occupation zone, according to the United Nations, but that doesn't bother Israel.
Right. It's Israel occupying part of Syria.
For decades now.
But we've got like 5 minutes left. What do you think are some of the possible scenarios here, going out? Because it doesn't look like it leads anywhere good.
Okay, so even if Trump did intend this as a one-off, a warning, him swinging his, unzipping his pants and swinging his big stick, trying to draw off some, domestic political pressure and proving that he's a strong president, even if he only intended this as a one-off strike, the neocons, the establishment, even the media, they're baying for blood. This is not enough for them. It's a slippery slope, and now the precedent is set. And in a way, Trump has taken responsibility. And they've created by this a kind of signal measure by which Al-Qaeda or any other jihadi or Islamist group can simply claim, whatever happened in Khan Shaykhun, that in the future, all they know they have to do is fake a gas attack, a chemical attack of any kind, and that the U.S. will feel the responsibility to respond. And they've already, of course, done this with Israel on the Golan Heights, where they've basically set up a process whereby Al-Qaeda fires a mortar into the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights, and then Israel responds with artillery and airstrikes, saying that Syria can't control their border area. And of course, instead of actually hitting Al-Qaeda, they hit the Syrian government and Hezbollah. We've already really established again, and it's the U.S. and Israel on that side acting as the air force for Al-Qaeda. So this is a slippery slope. There's too much precedent. There would be huge pressure by everyone in the U.S., and the Western world that applauded this, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turkeys, to go further. Turkey's calling for no-fly zones. Saudi wants to send troops in, and the neocons want regime change. So does Hillary Clinton.
Let me ask you then, really quickly, it's a difficult question, but, do you think that Trump's strategy for dealing with this so-called Russiagate thing is going to end up, and it's as dangerous as the scenario you just described because of the pressure to move forward from there, but do you think he's going to go to an apparent imminent confrontation with Russia and turn to the American people and say, okay, look, I'm ready and willing to go to war with them, should I, while people are teetering? Because, by the way, Tony Montero got a call from a student of his at Temple University saying that they were doing duck and cover drills at Temple, and he had heard many other American universities last week.
Well, during the Senate confirmation hearings, we had senators saying that their desks prevented them from Russian nuclear attacks during the Cold War, and that's quite an extraordinary level of hysteria. I don't think Trump is running the show anymore, and certainly not with foreign and military policy. I think that's already been signaled, they want regime change at the ideal scenario. They will settle for partition. Whether Trump intended this as a one-off, it certainly won't stop there. He's now bought into a degree of responsibility for what happens. He will be under all kinds of political pressure to act again if whatever incident happens, and that goes from there. There's already all kinds of talk, criticisms from other generals that McMaster's wants to send 150,000 ground troops into Syria. That, of course, would be a disaster of far greater than Iraqi proportions, because this time Russia, Iran, are involved as well. and on the ground in Syria. And they're not happy about what has happened already. And, you know, we're looking at potential escalation very quickly to that World War III scenario we were also worried about with Hillary Clinton.
And we're going to have to pick this up maybe later in the week as things develop. I really appreciate your time and your insight.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Thanks, Mark. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.